I'm exhausted. I just got done building my ship.
You wait, what? You build ships?
Yeah, just finished it. It took me a long time.
You built an entire ship? That's amazing. I didn't know this about you.
Yeah, I'll bring it up here later and show it to you.
Wait, where? How are you going to bring it up into my room? How are you going to bring a boat into my room?
Well, it's only about 10 inches long. It's a little model of a ship.
You didn't say that. Hey, wait a minute. We're rolling.
All right, well, let's roll. I'm Rich.
And I'm Mark.
And we are two guys on Block Island. What shall we do with Chuck and Sailor? We're going to have some fun talk today and some stories. This man is some people would consider a legend. Other people may be like, who the heck is he? But either way, I think you're going to really enjoy these conversations. And it's none other than David Lewis. Thank you, David, for joining us today.
Well, I'm delighted to be here and talk with you fellows.
And it's nice to officially meet you for the first time. I've seen you around where we know who each other is, but we've never actually really met, I don't think.
I think if there's an official band of Lewis Farm, it's the Booze Beggars.
We have been. We've been very fortunate in that the Lewis family has called upon the Booze Beggars to perform at the weddings of a number of Lewis progeny over the years. And I got to say, it's roundly, I think we mentioned it on the podcast. I think we did that. Whenever we get the chance to play a Lewis wedding, we jump at the opportunity because A, it's a great crowd of people, and B, it's usually out on the farm, which is a gorgeous setting.
You can't have a better venue.
Super nice.
For
We're on.
That's nice.
Yeah.
They're not that easy to get. You must hold a pretty high, ranking for the Booze Beggars to say yes.
You know, we do go back actually to the, early 2000s was the first time I think they played. Yeah. And when my brother was celebrating, had a picnic for all of the people that helped him build his house.
Yes.
And you played, I believe.
Yep, that's right. That was our first Lewis gig.
That's about 2006.
Oh. Yeah, that sounds about right.
And my recollection serves me that Pete Voskamp has made them all.
Yeah, Pete comes up, you know, from Washington, D.C. for these.
Well, when the demand happens, you show up.
The Booze Beggars are like the A-team. If you can find us, you can hire us.
And I was right. So when we were talking just before starting, David hadn't listened much to our podcast, which is fine. You know, not everybody's a podcast person, but he said, I listened to the beginnings of a couple of them, and I was expecting to hear, Block Island people and stuff. And he goes, I listened to the Booze Beggars. I was like, what? And then now I put it together because I was at first, I'm like, why would you pick that
house
one?
Band?
The Lewis Farm house band.
Yeah, that's enough about the Booze Beggars.
All right, that's fine. So where do we start? The usual spot. We want to hear a little bit about, where did you start on Block Island?
Well, I'll take you there in a minute. However, you've already introduced one of my favorite topics, which is building ships. Because I've spent 44 years of my entire career building ships.
Oh, I got that in my list.
We'll get to that later on.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I just turned 71, and I was born in 1951 in Rockville Center, New York. That's on Long Island in New York. And you say, why there? Well, the reality is, after the war, my parents wanted to build a house on the farm, but they didn't. So they bought the house on Old Town Road, where we all live, up on the hill behind Little Fields Gas Company called Meadow Hill. And they bought that in 46 and were able to scrape together enough laborers on Block Island, enough workers, the skilled workers, and enough material, shortages being what they were after World War II.
Oh, yeah.
But they bought an old 1877 house and added a garage, a master bedroom, a bathroom, and a kitchen, and they moved into it newly renovated, such as it was, in 1948, when my brother was 2 years old, and my sister was a couple months old, and I was still not there.
Okay. So, all right.
I think women in today's women, as well as women in my mother's generation, typically, once they've started with an obstetrician, they keep going back.
Yes, yes.
So that's how I was born. All three of us were born in Rockville Center, New York, because during the war, mom and dad were married in 1941 in January, and 12 months later was Pearl Harbor. And mom grew up in Manhattan. Dad obviously was born and raised on Block Island. And so during those war years, she lived with her mother down in Hempstead, Long Island, and that's how she got involved with an obstetrician down there when Keith was born, and
And
the rest
it.
Is history.
Stick with
that little bit of history is pretty well nailed down.
Okay, so they were living here year round when she was getting ready to have you,
right?
And they so purposely left to go be where they your mom had already had a couple of kids, or
right.
Well, yeah.
Interesting about that. You know, the way you got things like moving vans over to Black Island in 1948 was to hire a barge and have it towed over with a tugboat.
Yeah.
So. Oh. That happened in sometime in May, and it must have been shortly after Nancy was born because her birthday is in May. And within a couple of days, Dad was called back to work. He was a ship's mate at that point. And he was called back to work, and he went back to work almost immediately after leaving my mother and two kids in a house in a community she knew, but she had never lived in year-round.
Oh,
wow.
Now in those,
you're gonna love Block Island. It's great. I gotta go.
Right. In those days, you know, merchant marine officers didn't get the kind of vacation that they do now. Dad only had about 2 weeks of vacation on an annual basis.
Oh, really?
He was fortunate enough to be around when all three of his kids were born, but then it was always back to work. You know, the work is just as hard or harder today for maritime officers, but there's enough time off that you can lead the seafaring life and the home life as well.
Yeah. Now, don't they do more like a month on and 3 weeks off now? It's sort of like that, or do they?
Well, I remember when Keith was going, my brother was going around in the years around 2000 anyway, it was full 6 months on, 6 months off, not continuous, but that was how it ratioed out. You know, I have no idea how it has changed right now.
Yeah.
But the world continues to change, especially in the world of seafaring.
Oh, yeah. They got some traffic jams now. That's all you hear about is stuff backed up. And
boats getting stuck in canals,
yeah,
sideways,
it's
that
challenging
kind of thing.
I don't know if I could live that life, you know?
It sounds like a commitment, to say the least. Like,
so,
once you're out on that boat, you're
right
out there.
Well, you know, reality is you can't lead that double life in those days. You could not leave that double life. Dad left the sea in 1952, the year after I was born, and came and lived with his family on Block Island, and he's been here ever since, And the reason was he didn't want to miss out on raising his family.
Well, you know what? And that's important. You know, there's a price to be paid for that. A lot of people have to do that for work, and I think it's important to be there if, you know, you want to help sculpt the young minds of, and clearly it worked out pretty good. It was a good choice, I think.
I'd say so.
From the Lewises I know, you know. Before we go too much further, so your dad was born and raised here on Block Island.
Correct.
And what about the generation before him? I mean, when did the families start to come to Block Island or know about or live here? So was it your grandfather or...
You know, I don't know how many grands we need to go back.
Okay, that's enough of an answer for me.
But the simple answer is the Lewis Farm was founded in 1817.
Okay, yeah.
And the Lewises, those Lewises came originally from somewhere in South County, Rhode Island. And that was probably within the previous 10 years. I don't really know that answer.
So whatever the accurate answer would be, it would probably start with a great, great, great. Something like that.
I think
that.
We go back nine generations to a gravestone of... I think his name was Isaiah Lewis, who was somewhere billiard around exit 3 off 95.
That's
wow. In one of the historical cemeteries? Like,
yes.
Yeah. Oh,
wow.
Pretty neat. Pretty neat.
Now, so would you guys could be considered swamp Yankees? I don't mean, is that a pejorative term? I don't mean to throw it out there if it is.
I think I'd refer to us as farmers and fishermen.
Fair enough.
Because that's what all of the generations on Block Island up until it stopped being a farm in 64 when my grandfather died.
Yeah.
Everybody on Block Island survived because they were farmers and fishermen.
And what did Lewis farm? What were you farming? What was being farmed from the onset?
I've got so many questions. And that's what you talked about your dad, you know, deciding that it was more important to be here to raise you kids. So, you know, change a career. That's when he farmed? Is that what he did when he got here?
No, he bought what used to be John Rosen Company over where Persephone's is now and the Lazy Fish. He bought the hardware store that was resident in that building, but he never owned the building. He just bought the business.
The business, okay.
And that business, he worked in that with my mother until they retired and liquidated in the early 80s.
I remember that hardware store.
So that's where the hardware store was.
Yeah, I remember it. I was in there as a little
kid. Was it still $24 for a nail back then?
Oh, you can get two.
You can get two for 24. Right. Oh, bargains. Bargain basement prices.
Yeah, it was so cool because my memory of it is, you know, just the old-fashioned hardware store.
Yeah.
There was just shelves and bins and everything was just, you know, but, you know, if I recall, you know, just lots of wooden crates and different things like that. It wasn't like the modern, you know, high-tech metal shelving and all that. It was pretty cool. Yeah. So that, all right, that's an interesting one.
So, you know, growing up on Block Island, as I had, one of the things I was always appreciative, even to this day, is the ability to buy something on the island when you need it.
Yeah.
And that extends even to milk. And it extends to just about anything we would need, not just to survive, but to live comfortably on Block Island. Comfortable is a subjective term.
Yeah.
But the reality is, I don't know that people on Block Island show adequate appreciation for the business owners who stick it out here 12 months a year or 8 or 10 months a year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Speaking for the restaurants, you know, it's a challenge. Yeah. We all know it's hard to make a living on Block Island, and it's even harder to afford to live on Block Island. And you got to be appreciative for the efforts that Mary Jane and Petey and Kimberly and Frank DiBiase and others who I didn't have this list prepared to tick off on my mind.
Yeah, that's fine. We know, you know what you're talking about.
You got to be thankful, and part of being thankful is giving them enough business to survive.
Yes. Yeah. I think that one of the things I've enjoyed watching happening, because I did my time, I opened a restaurant, and I did a few years year-round, and it was very, very, it was fun, and it was like, you just were a part of the community. But what happened was, and people can't help it, they get, how many times can you go do the same thing over and over again? So after several years, we said, all right, well, you know, it's not, there's less people. But I do feel that what has helped that in turn helps the rest of the community by having it now available is that the year-round population has grown considerably, right. I think. So there's actually enough to sustain, a few places staying open, and they seem to kind of cooperate a little bit. You know, well, when are you closing? If Kimberly's going to close for 2 months. You know, that's when somebody else will choose. Macaloons will decide to open, and that's key. But I think that growth in the last decade has really has helped that sustainability. And like you said, people going out and supporting them. And I think that, you know, some people are, you know, kind of like, remember when winter was nice and quiet here, and now no matter what, I passed 3 cars on the way home today. Can you believe that? It's February. But I think that that's helped that cause a little bit.
Yes.
And I think, but you're right. I think supporting them is important because it was tough. It was very tough to do for, you know, for us.
So two responses to what you just said. All good.
Oh,
number one,
doesn't have to be.
I've eaten a lot of chicken masala in my life, but the best chicken masala is still at Sharky's.
Oh, wow. There's a compliment.
Look at that.
Wow. Uh-huh.
So that's right. Number one. Now, I've forgotten number two.
Well, we'll get back to it.
Let's see.
That's the nice thing about this podcast.
Oh,
yeah, things come and go.
When people ask me about living on Black Island and the hustle and bustle and how difficult it is for the year-round people or people who are even here 6 months of the year to deal with the summer crowds and the influx of visitors, day trippers and whatnot, it just amazes me. It doesn't amaze me. I like my response to that in spite of all of those challenges, if you live on Black Island, you're a survivor. But more importantly, Black Island is a more viable community than the one I grew up in.
Yeah. Really?
To this day.
Wow.
How so?
Just about in every respect. You know, we have the economy has helped. People live more comfortably than the 50s, 60s, even 70s scenario. So that certainly is a contributor. The community is more active. We have more services than we've ever had before.
Yes.
And relatively speaking, there's more sociability because there are more people and there are more things to do, although those take different forms than they did in the 60s and 70s and 50s. I mean, certainly the St. Patrick's Day bingo at the Fire Barn when it was pouring rain and you had to walk through 8 inches of water to get out of the building.
And inside the building was inches.
Well, that was in the floor, but fortunately, that was only getting the fire engines wet. But you get the point, you know?
Yes, yes.
I mean, you know, in many respects, a rising tide lifts all boats. And that's been the story of my observation about the viability of the Block Island community.
Yeah. When I hear people complain, and you know, I've been guilty of it once in a while.
We all have.
Yeah, when you complain a little bit about the summer and bursting at the seams and everything, I always have to step back and say, that's how we're able to be here year round. Otherwise, we'd be just like an island off Maine where the pipes get drained and everything gets pulled out. There's not even water to the island. It just gets completely shut down. You know what I mean? And and I think it's a good, well-rounded place to be right now. And like you said, the services that even I've seen in my 30 years living here year round, especially, and I think it's great, services for the seniors has really gone up because that population is definitely growing out here. It's a fun place to retire, but I agree with you. I think it's a pretty neat observation on how the island is. Yeah. So
I've always had a healthy respect for anyone that lives here year round, because I did try, I think I've talked about this, my second summer, I think, on the island. I didn't really have, I was in my 20s, didn't have big plans for the winter. And I said, well, I'll just stay here for the winter. And I made it to the first week of November, and I was like, I got to go. I needed, it was too quiet for me. It's just the way my brain would have gone crazy.
Always nervous if somebody tells me they live here year round in October.
How long have you lived here? That's my first year.
That's a sentence for May 1st.
Yeah.
Right? If you're still here, you did it. You know what I mean?
So let me take you back closer to the beginning and tell you about my first recollection of life on Block Island.
Please.
Great.
That's awesome.
So I was 4 years old. It was 1955. And we were down on Pebbly Beach, which is what the beach out in front of St. Andrew's Parish Center used to be called. Not many people know that name any longer.
We have to write that down.
We have to add that to our list of
beaches. We keep a list of beach names because, some are officially named, some are just colloquial.
Pebbly Beach. So you're talking down off the point there where you see all the seals now a lot of times on the rocks.
Right. Yep. I haven't actually been there myself for decades, other than from the porch of the parish center.
Yeah, but same.
In the old days, you could find garnets on that area of rocky beach, and you could find rocks that held garnets in them. So we were down there on one August Sunday, we as a family, looking for garnets. I was four.
I'm dumb. What's a garnet? Do you know what a garnet is, Mark?
I do.
Is it a gem or some sort of a mineral?
Well, I don't want to get this completely wrong, look stupid, but that's nothing new.
Get used to it.
I believe it's a rock that is, when you cut it in half inside, it's all
crystallized.
Okay. Is that?
Okay.
No.
I didn't know. I'm like, yeah, of course I know what that is.
But the good news, I know what you're talking about, and I know what I'm talking about.
Okay, well, we're here to talk to you.
Tell us what a garnet is.
Well, a garnet is a semi-precious gem.
Okay.
So you'll find garnets in rings, in earrings, and whatnot. Is it actually the birthstone for people born in the month of January?
Okay,
I think.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Yeah.
So you can find them. I've got garnets that my dad has found in his lifetime, and I don't know how I came to hold them, but I'm passing them on to the next generation, that are as big as my thumbnail.
Wow.
Just the garnet, because you can find the garnets that are not embedded in an Ignatius rock.
Yeah.
And you can with the appropriate tools, they can be harvested out of those rocks, which obviously is what the gemstone people do, but I have no idea how they're doing that. But we've got a few of those rocks around this size with garnets in them around our outdoor yard right now.
First time I've ever heard of such a thing.
Geode. Yeah. I was thinking of geode.
Geode. That's exactly
what I was thinking. Yeah, the geode.
Geode. That's what I was thinking.
Okay.
All right. Sorry.
So the garnet's an actual gem, and you would find them down there on Pebbly Beach.
Right.
Wow.
That's right.
And I was going to say maybe, you know, like Captain Kidd's treasure chest washed out of the cliff in a hurricane, but if the fact that you found rocks with them in them too, that means that that's it. They're there naturally. So
that's right.
I wonder if they're. I don't want to go down that road.
It was precursor to the modern day orb phenomenon.
I feel like I could go. I feel like I could go 20 minutes just talking about garnets now on Pebbly Beach.
Yeah.
So got information just picked up right there. Mm. Fantastic.
If the world is lucky, they've all been picked over.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I would imagine.
Otherwise, there'll be a mad dash for people down there to walk over all those rocks, which is no fun.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, we already checked. They're all gone, so don't scare the seals.
Yeah, just stick with the orbs.
So that's just the backstory to the story.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The story continues, and the drama increases dramatically. So we're driving home and coming up the hill. In those days, that roadway was not paved like it is now, and it was just one of the toughest dirt roads you could ever imagine driving up.
Oh, the one that snakes like through the S curves and up. We're going that way, like up towards the Southeast Light from there?
No, going back to Mom and Dad's house on Old Town Road.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And we get to the top of the hill, and there's smoke coming out of the new master bedroom that was just built 6 years previous, or 8 years previous, in 1946. So obviously there was a fire in the house, and I was 4 years old, and I remember myself clearly standing out on the hillside there and seeing my brother, who's 5 years older than me, with a garden hose spraying water into the fire area. I can't remember seeing any open flame, just smoke. And obviously my mother must have gone in the house to call the fire department, who showed up PDQ pretty darn quick, of course. Now, so what people would be interested in hearing about is how they went about putting this fire out. The entire bedroom was destroyed, and there was smoke and water damage throughout the entire house. So it gives you an indication of the amount of the work involved to putting the fire out and then getting organized and wrapping the situation up. So most people don't know it, but there's a stream that crosses the road from draining Great Swamp up behind the airport.
Yep.
And cuts across the street and right in across from my driveway, Mom and Dad's driveway, and goes into the field where little fields have a nice
stand
of spruce trees.
Yeah.
And typically that's dry in August.
Yeah, usually.
So with the town had two fire trucks today, just like today. Well, they have a few more today, but when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s, and up until the fire department expanded dramatically to meet the needs of the growing community, there always seemed to be two fire trucks. There was the old one, and there was the new one. And when you got a new one, the new one became the old one.
Yeah. Edie Blaine told us about the arrival of the first fire truck and what a momentous occasion that was.
Right, so. That was. Well, I think that was a new fire trick that she might have spoken of.
Yeah, maybe replacing the old one.
Oh, my bad. Not the first.
Because
the one that
she talked about in her video last summer, which was so nicely done, was there was a picture of Ed in that open cab fire truck that he had just brought over from the mainland, Ed Blaine being her husband.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's the one she was talking about.
And yeah, I think if I recall right, Peter as a preschooler was sitting in the cab of that truck. Okay. In the open cab, I think. There was a young child there. I think that was the 1937 Dodge that was always considered Cliff Rose's favorite truck when he was a fireman's age and is now a historical piece over in Jamestown Fire Department.
Oh, wait.
Is it really?
Yeah. Now, I think that's the same truck.
Okay.
So the truck that I'm calling the new truck, I don't know whether it's that 37 Dodge or not. I think it may be.
I think it could be.
Except the time frame doesn't line up between Peter Blaine being alive. He wasn't born in 1955 when this fire took place.
We'll have to do. Yeah. Here's one thing we love about this podcast is the mysteries and trying to get figured out. So let's put this one. We'll do some research.
Yeah.
Edie and I have talked about that photograph of Peter and Ed in that truck. She and I didn't talk about the conflict in the dates of the 37 Dodge and the 55 fire and Peter's birth. Right. We haven't talked about that yet.
We have a team of forensic analysts that we employ sometimes. We'll get them on it.
So anyway, the new fire truck, which was better equipped to get up the hill, there's a cistern. All the old houses had cisterns. So we had a full cistern that wasn't being used just off the kitchen. So they went to the top of the hill and they pumped water out of the cistern while the old fire truck was at the bottom of the hill, pumping water up the hill to the new fire truck so that by the time they emptied the cistern, they could be getting water out of that drain, essentially, as it is. Like I said, that drain in my older lifetime has typically always been almost bone dry in August. So anyway, how that mystery was resolved, I have no clue.
Maybe a good thunderstorm filled up the Great Swamp.
It could be.
Now, the Great Swamp, if I'm right, where you're talking about where it runs off, you actually can go down the road past the High View, and all at the end is the Boy Scout camp, and the Great Swamp is conveniently like a mosquito farm down there for the poor Boy Scouts.
That's correct.
In my book, that area has the most mosquitoes I've ever... I've walked down to that Boy Scout camp in an August day, and you're in minutes, they're just all on you, because that's the swamp. But that's the Great yeah. Swamp, just so we share with people, because, you know, they may not. I try to give them a visual over the right. the mic of where you're talking about. And then that has a little teeny stream, and you'll see it if you're heading from the Old Town Inn to Littlefields or to town. You'll see it right before, right where the hill is, the right. big house up on the hill. And
that's
it's
right.
Just, and then it creeps through Littlefield's property, and, you know, and he has the little trees there.
That's right.
Yeah.
So anyway, the denouement to that story is 2 weeks later, we were, what we, so we had no place to live. So.
Oh, that's it, right. Homeless.
Yeah. Ed Tripler and his wife, Linda, who are Diane Tripler's parents, they were the owners of the Neptune House in those days. And they had, I don't know if they rented rooms or if they just had a couple of apartments, but they had an apartment that was suitable for year-round living. And we moved over into that apartment for 3 months while our house was made ready for at least for living again.
I was going to say, and that's all it took, 3 months in that time?
No, that's all it
took. Just to get it.
Just to get it functional.
Yeah. yeah.
Functional. You know, the core functional meant I suspect there was major over... That entire bedroom was wiped out. Oh. So I really don't know what functional meant. My recollection doesn't, my memory doesn't recall
yeah.
anything beyond that.
You might have blocked some of it out.
Yeah. A lot of it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure
and the functional is a floating, to get out of a hotel and back into your house, a little less function is probably okay.
That's right.
You don't yeah. need it to be yeah. perfect. Just yeah. get me home. You
One
know?
Thing's for sure, there wasn't a TV to be destroyed.
right.
Yeah, all the electronics were, you know, non, you know, they didn't, no problems.
Years
there.
Away from yeah. those, yeah.
yeah. Right.
Well, that's cool.
That's right.
Wow.
So that was 4 years old. That's your first, you know.
Recollection of life.
And really? I'm just flashing back, though. You said your brother was 5 years old. So at 9 years old, he's trying to put the fire out with a just a garden hose.
Right.
That's, wow.
That's pretty
Let's see.
Tough that, cookies.
I was going to say, how many nine-year-olds would even know to do that these days?
I think they'd be taking pictures to put it on social
right,
media.
Right, Instagram. They'd be like, oh, selfies with the yeah, fire. Like,
oh, my house is on fire. Isn't this cool?
OMG.
Well, oh, you know, I said a while back in response to something that you said that, you know, if you're living here year-round, you're a survivor.
Right.
Yeah.
And that covers
yeah.
a yeah. lot of territory.
It does.
Truth.
It does. So, you know, my first traumatic experience was my grandfather was mowing, and I learned to ride it later, but it was the old school gravelly with the big blade in the front, you know, the town used to use them. They kind of have that round front mm-hmm. on them. And I got a phone call. I don't know if I told this story on the podcast ever before. I got a phone call. So my grandfather hopped on the mower, and on my way walking to the house, I hear this clank, the blade snapped in half from hitting a rock. And boomeranged across the yard and took a chunk right out of my right leg, like right,
oh
above,
my God.
Right above the knee. So what do? You put you in the car and you drive you up to the doctor's office. There was no, you yeah. know, I don't
no
even know if we had a
ambulance.
Phone where, yeah. you know. Well, I think by the time that you called it, they raised the whistle. Everybody would show up and you'd tell them where the problem was. It was just faster to get me in the car and just drive you in. So, you know, right. you're just survivalist. You just go.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but yeah, so that's, it's pretty funny how, you know, the survivalists are out here yeah. as a kid. They're like, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
I'm like,
you'll be all right. Shake it off, kid.
Yeah. mm-hmm. Yeah.
So after the fire happens, you're back in the house. And then what happens next in your life?
Well, then I went into first grade. So the first grade in Block Island School and that. In that year for me, I was the oldest in among the four of us. There was Martha Ball, whose birthday is in June. Cliff Rose, who I've spoken of already, and his birthday is in August. And Georgia Hall was the third person. I was the fourth. I don't remember exactly when Georgia was born, but it was sometime later in the year than April.
Yep.
So that was the first recollection. And, you know, I have to say a lot about being in the first, second, and third grades with Gertrude Ball.
Oh, Gertie.
Before I get to that, though, just I think most of us are aware that are here year-round know that back in those days, 1950, mid-50s, there was no kindergarten and no preschool. That was all happening outside. If it was happening at all, it was with a Dick and Jane book that was borrowed from the school so mothers could get kids reading a little bit ahead of time. And that's exactly what was happening with the four of this incoming class in the first grade in 1957. You know, we had all read all most of the Dick and Jane books with our parents by the time we got there.
So and those books would just get passed around in the community for with the kids, whoever had the kids that age.
Well, they probably came right from the school, and you took them back to the school. Because, you know, in those days,
get a head start on reading. Yeah.
That's exactly what the parents did. They wanted to get a head start because those facilities weren't there.
And look, homeschooling is so chic right now.
Right.
It's a thing, right? Yeah.
That's right. I never thought of it in that sense, but we were ready.
Yeah. You could have written one. See Dick and Jane put out a fire.
Yeah.
At age 9.
Right?
Unbelievable.
Wow. In a class of 4. Your entire class was 4 people.
Right. Right. But in those days, the primary grades 1, 2, and 3 were all in the same classroom with one teacher.
Okay.
One teacher, no aides, just one teacher for the whole day. And then the junior high, the elementary 4, 5, and 6 were all in the second room with another teacher. And it's somewhere in that elementary time frame as through in junior high, it started to transition where you had multiple teachers depending on the discipline. But those teachers were bouncing across different rooms. It's not like you had more than one teacher assigned to a room, if you were.
Right. Hey, we're going to keep going, but we're just going to take a 1-minute break for our sponsors. So we'll be right back with David Lewis. Hang in there, listeners. This is a great, great chat about the old days. Loving it. Cooler?
Check.
Ice?
Check.
Drinks?
Check.
That's everything.
All right, let's head down to Fishworks.
All right, I'm excited for this trip.
I am too. And you know what's cool about Fishworks is, I mean, hey, today we're going to go out and try and catch some striped bass, right? But you can get bluefish, fluke, sea bass, bonito, whatever's in season.
Yeah, you can book a light tackle or fly fishing morning charter with Captain Chris for up to 3 people.
Right. Oh, wait a minute. I invited some friends, so we might have to go out on the Harley with Captain Hank because they do half trips and full day trips for up to 6 people.
Oh, and Captain Hank is a hoot. And, of course, the shop, you know, the Fishworks Tackle Shop, they have everything you need, including pointers. If you don't want to go on a charter, they can sell you what you need, tell you where to go and how to do it.
Yeah, totally. I think I might pick up a hat and a T-shirt, too, because their merchandise is so on point.
Yeah, good-looking stuff. They're located at 40 Ocean Avenue, and they're open every day in season, and great merchandise.
They really do have some cool stuff. And if you want to check it out online, you can purchase all year long at www.bifishworks.com.
All right.
How cool is that?
Ah, I love it.
All right. Let's go catch some fish. Hey, Rich, do these bell bottoms make me look fat?
Bell bottom? Oh, wait. It must be Monday and you're going to Disco Night at Captain Nick's.
Well, yeah, of course I'm going to Disco Night at Captain Nick's. I'm the DJ, man. I got to be there.
That place is so much fun.
So much fun. And the fun doesn't end after Monday because on Tuesday and Wednesdays, we have dueling pianos followed by Dr. Wes Chesterton's Sloppy Seconds.
What are Sloppy Seconds?
Well, that's when I play the piano for the rest of the drunk people there at the end of the night.
Oh, that sounds fun in itself. And Thursdays, they've got live acoustic acts and full bands and DJs.
Yeah. And Friday and Saturday afternoons, we have acoustic acts on the deck at 5:30. Fridays are Delaney, and then Saturdays are buddy Rob Davis.
And then Friday and Saturday nights, they've got the best live bands on Block Island, like Derek and the Fun Bags, the Blushing Brides, Fever, Neil and the Vipers, West End Blend, and the High and Mighty Brass Band, just to name a few.
Yeah, and the bands aren't over just because Friday and Saturday night ends. On Sunday afternoons, the Young Guns take the stage on the deck at 5:30.
Sunday fun day, and what if you're hungry? They got food. Food, right?
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So they've serving food out of the Captain Galley 7 days a week, including some late night grub. So, you know, if you're hungry, stop in late night and grab a bite.
Yeah. And if you want to check out the full entertainment schedule, let's just head over to CaptainNicksBI.com.
All right. I'm going to head down to the club.
Wait a minute. There's a club out here?
Is it
like a private club? Can I come?
No, Club Soda.
Oh.
You know the place. They are purveyors of fine food, free advice, and magical elixirs.
You know what else? If you're looking for local color, Rich, this is the place you want to go.
The murals around the wall by H.D. Weatherby are incredible.
Yeah. I heard that he paid off his bar tab by painting that panorama.
Well, I don't think he could drink enough to cover what he did there.
That's for sure. Hey, you know what else? Monday night is trivia night at 9 p.m., and they've got half-price wings all night.
And on Tuesdays, it's karaoke time.
Ooh, we should go and sing a Carpenter's song.
I love Carpenter's
song. Why do birds
suddenly appear?
Oh, wait, I just remembered. On Wednesdays, it's musical bingo night. How much fun is that?
Ugh, that sounds like fun. And Thursdays and Fridays, it's the acoustic showcase.
I've seen that. And you know, they get some great artists there to perform. And then on Saturday, it's full live bands.
Ugh, Sounds like a fun place to go.
Totally.
That's why I'm going.
All right.
So check them out at their website, clubsoda.com, or you can give them a call at 401-466-5397.
And you know what they say at Club Soda? We're all here because we're not all there. Discovering the hidden gems of Block Island is one of the greatest parts about visiting. While the Atlantic Inn is far from hidden, it is most certainly one of the gems. Perched at the top of High Street, the Atlantic Inn offers stunning views of Old Harbor, Crescent Beach, and all the way back to the mainland, or America, as we like to call it. But views aren't the only thing that make this gorgeously maintained Victorian beauty one of Block Island's must-see destinations. Well-appointed yet cozy rooms offer guests all of the relaxation they need after a hard day at the beach. Innkeepers Brad and Ann Marthens are the quintessential hosts, and they love sharing their expansive knowledge of food and great wine with their guests. The restaurant at the Atlantic serves exquisitely crafted gourmet fare. Their thoroughly curated wine list offers varietals and vintages that will pair beautifully with whatever you're dining on. Perhaps the greatest thing about the Atlantic Inn is their incredible tapas and cocktails menu offered outside on the deck and front lawn. Kick back in an Adirondack chair, take in the view, and breathe a sigh of relief. You can tell your friends that you finally found it. The Atlantic Inn, a Block Island gem hidden in plain sight. For more information, please visit AtlanticInn.com. Rich, you know, there is no better place to just chill out and watch the sunset than the Atlantic.
You sit out there in the Adirondacks and have a little drink brought to you. And, you know, the view is spectacular and the staff is just great.
The staff's fantastic and the tapas are out of this world.
Just delicious.
Yeah. We like to have like a little glass of wine, some olives, and just kind of feel like we're in Europe.
And they do up there. It's just beautiful.
And so did you learn by osmosis? So while you're in the class learning your first grade material, obviously I would assume you're overhearing the second and third grade material being taught to those kids.
Right.
So is it the kind of thing where when you got to second or third grade, you were like, yeah, I learned this in first grade?
I don't really have a clear recollection of that happening.
Okay.
I don't really know how that all happened, you know.
Yeah.
Just that I can say without a doubt in my mind, whatever Gertrude Ball did, it was successful.
Okay.
And that's what I hope to share with you right now by just sort of pointing out the kind of person she was. She was a person, and her being in her class for 3 years, first, second, and third grade, was a memory that I look back on all the time with fondness and joy. And I can see a lot of people would understand the fondness, but the joy that I took from her classrooms, and I hope the other kids did as well, has followed me in my entire life. One of which being, and this may get Mark's attention and he may start to laugh a little bit, but I always liked to sing, and
okay.
I attribute her to that reason, because she had the only piano in school, and she was she trained as a teacher, and she was a trained pianist for that kind of work.
Okay.
You know, she played piano very well, sight read and everything. And so there were no formal school music programs that I'm aware of in those early years that made music mandatory in any sense. But a lot of the different grades, and for graduation and various other occasions, Gertrude Ball always had the responsibility of organizing the older kids, and particularly the older girls, into choruses for special occasions. You know, some of the ones that are obvious candidates for mention are, there was always a Veterans Day service over at the Legion Park, and an assortment of Veterans Day songs would be groomed, I should say, by Gertrude Ball with the older girls and even the younger kids to sing those songs at Legion Park on Veterans Day, which was always held on the holiday. Of course, that holiday has never moved, but it was never a school holiday.
Right.
Or if it was a state holiday, we went to school anyway.
Well, yeah. What else? You know, a good thing to go do. Yeah, we actually talked in one of our mini pods about how the piano used to be like a centerpiece, an entertainment center, you know, in the old days,
right.
It was an entertainment center where people would gather around, and you know,
you would invite other families to your house or whoever had the piano, and that was a form of going out or socializing.
Sure,
you know?
That's right.
Yeah,
it's pretty neat you bring that.
So, what songs did you sing?
Well, let's see. You know, let me cover it by occasion, and then I'll get to some more general ones.
Okay.
on Veterans Day, it was always, well, I guess I can't remember the Veterans Day, but the portfolio included some of the songs that would happen with between that would be sung to represent men going off to war and they're you know partying with their loved one for the first time or the last time, you know, those kinds of things that you might recollect. There's a famous duet that slips my memory for the name right now, but
is it "You'll Never Know How Much I Miss You"? You know that song?
That sounds too modern.
Oh, that's from back then. I think my grandfather taught me.
Uh huh. Well, okay, let me move on from
that. That's all right. Yeah, sure. I'll sing it later.
Great.
You'll never know just how much I miss you.
Till We Meet Again is the name.
Till We Meet Again.
Yeah. It's a lovely, very short duet. Some of the words are smile the while I kiss you merrily or something like that. And it's a nice duet and it's ends until we meet again. That's the name of the song.
Okay.
Yeah, it's sort of it's not a goodbye. It's not a goodbye.
It's just the song. Until we meet again.
That was terrifying. Large numbers. Yeah. In those days, I mean, everybody who serves today is just so happy, so proud. It's so important for our nation to have, you know, all the people that serve.
Sure.
But back then, in a hard war, the chances were up there. Yeah. You weren't coming back. Sure. They were up there. I mean, you know, it's going to take a really unique experience for you to be killed in action. It was
50-50.
Thousands and thousands and thousands, you know? So.
And it was the same thing for preparation for Memorial Day. And then it was high school baccalaureate, which they don't have it. Baccalaureate service for all of the school participated, but it was obviously for the graduates every year. And that typically took place in one of the churches back in the 50s and early 60s till that became unconstitutional.
Oh, yeah.
And then, so there's baccalaureate graduation, and then there was just whatever she would be doing with the older girls throughout the season. But those baccalaureate service and at the graduation service, there would be some popular tunes of the day. Graduation would feature The Impossible Dream one year, I remember.
Okay.
And, you know, the modern contemporary songs of the day.
Of the day.
Right. And yeah. Not necessarily memorializing anything, but just contemporary songs of the day.
Okay. So there was a period in my life where I was, I'm just going to say I went to church more than I do now.
Yeah,
but it actually included some weekdays, and there would only be about five or six of us. You know, again, I think now if you were to go to 8 a.m. Mass in July, there's probably a lot of people there. But, you know, back when I first lived here, that was not, you know. So I would go in, and it would pretty much be me and Gertrude.
Really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
So what year does that go back to?
Oh, gosh, that's got to be back into the early 80s and 90s, because that's about, you know, I would think that's the time. Because she was still around for a while, right? I mean,
I don't really remember when she stopped teaching, and I don't know when she died exactly.
Well, she was up there, and she was, but she was still with it. You know, she was still fun to talk to and, you know, sassy.
Sassy. And you said she was Gertrude Ball, and one of your classmates was Martha Ball. Was that aunt, mother, any relation? Obviously, some sort of
I don't think there was a relationship there because Gertrude Ball married a Ball, obviously. She grew her maiden name was Murphy.
Okay.
And she was, I'm a little weak on these relationships amongst all these Balls and Murphys.
So are we. That's one of the interesting things about
but Jimmy Murphy, who owned the Mott House down on Corneck Road, and he died in recent years.
Okay.
And Patty Murphy.
I know. Yeah.
Who's an intemperate. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Jim Murphy, yeah.
So they're all of the Murphy family that I'm speaking of. And you might be, I don't know how long you've been around, Mark, but.
I got here in 96.
You wouldn't remember that. Rich, when did you first show up?
Well, you know, like you, the memories of 1970, you know, and so I was two and 3 years old. So, but
you're,
yeah.
You're right on the cusp of but not being able to remember Frank Murphy, who was the cop
in the 50s and
60s.
When I was that little, I didn't have the interactions that I do with the police.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right. So anyway, Frank Murphy and Gertrude Murphy were brother and sister.
Okay.
Gertrude Murphy being Gertrude Ball. Marrying Searles
Ball.
So
then she married out of the Murphy and married into the Ball family.
And so Frank Murphy actually, just to bring it current, he owns He always lived, when he came here summers to be a policeman, in the house which is now offshore property. And now it's coast.
So
down there.
Quick question then. You just said that he would come here to be a cop in the summer. So
even back then,
was there no cop in the winter, or he was just an extra helper? They even back then, they would bring an extra police officer on. Or did we?
Well, so back in my earliest memories, and I could be a little uncertain about this, but you know, we have the Tom Sergeant, who was an elected official in the town for serving papers and whatnot.
Yes, we still have that to this day.
Yes.
Yeah.
But in those days, he may have played the role of chief enforcement officer, to use my term.
Oh, okay. The town sergeant actually
did some sergeanting. Right. And Frank Murphy would come for probably a 4-month season, maybe a 5-month season in the summertime. And then there was another cop, another gentleman named Bunty Carr, who used to live up on High Street. And he had a daughter who was a little bit older than me, which puts her 80-ish now probably for her. If she's still alive, I haven't even heard of these folks for decades. Obviously, Bunty Carr is passed long gone, but he came down and he was Frank's auxiliary policeman.
Okay.
Second hand, I guess. He was the backup.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
So
they did, it did follow a trend of beefing it up for the summer, even back then.
Right. Well, yeah. It's at some point in the 60s, Bobby Rose was made the police chief, and I think that might have been the first police chief.
Full year-round police chief.
And maybe Arthur Rose might have been that. Marshall Rose. Well, you might know Marshall Rose. Marshall Rose?
Nope. I know Bobby and I'm sorry. Which you said Arthur, and then you said which other Rose?
Yeah, you remember Arthur Rose.
Oh, yes. Yeah, very well.
He
might have
been the police chief before Bobby Rose. So I have to go back and check the check somebody's documentation.
I wonder if they
that.
Were cousins or they were they cousins? Because Larry is Bobby's brother. So there was Larry and Bobby Rose, and then there was Arthur Rose.
Right. And, okay. I don't know if it's hard to sort out all the Roses, just like it's hard to sort out the Littlefields.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So presumably they're all related somewhere, through blood.
And sometimes we want to know, and sometimes we may not want to know.
Yeah. Right.
But no, that's
happens.
But that's that's it. I have heard the funny term with the Littlefields, because there is two kind of branches, and you'll ask a Littlefield, you know, oh, you must be cousins with so-and-so. I'm like, nope.
That's the other branch.
That's the other branch. They're down there.
Chris Blaine did tell me the other day that his Littlefield branch isn't cousins with Chris Littlefield's branch.
It is.
Chris Littlefield and Chris Blaine are cousins.
Yeah, see, we could go.
But we don't know whether that's first, second, third, or 27th cousin, you know.
This is, again, one of the things on this podcast is just the intricacy of the families intertwining out here in the names. And I mean, it goes so far back that it's fascinating.
Right.
You know, I find out that someone that I've been talking to for years and been friends with, that this other person that I have been talking to, it's their brother or sister or cousin or mother or father. I had no idea for years. It's really...
I call it the faux pas glance. Before you make a faux pas and you're at a gathering, you kind of scan around real quick to make sure that... that you're going to say anything bad, but you might be telling an amusing story that someone else might not find so amusing.
Right.
And you just want to make sure you don't, you know, drop the ball on that one.
Now let me go back to Gertrude Ball,
yes,
though.
Yes, please.
Then, first off, Michael O'Brien, who teaches at the school now.
Yeah.
Gertrude Ball was her grandmother, his grandmother.
Yeah.
So we got that spread in a way.
That's definitely the one I went to church
with. And as my wife was looking, thinking about the things I might be telling you today, she said, don't forget Rosalie and Phil O'Brien.
Oh, yeah.
Who also are part of that family.
Yep.
Yep.
So, and you know, I can't throw out too many names at once, but having the right segue.
Yeah, that's where I heard the name Gertie, which I wasn't allowed to ever use when I was talking to Gertrude Ball. But,
so I told you about... the four of us starting first grade together. So Patty Donnelly came in the second grade, and she joined our party of four and became a band of five. And it was the same group of kids in first, second, and third grade, as well as fourth and fifth grade.
Okay.
Those five of us were the core of what ultimately would become an 11-class high school graduation class in 1969. But the five of us were all together since second grade, and the four of us were all together since the first grade. We were the only continuity out of those 11 people that ended up graduating.
Wow.
And I mentioned Patty coming in at second grade, but she's part of us. She grew up with us.
Yeah.
So that, just to be technically precise, it's important to acknowledge that she was came in on the second grade, because that's what all the other good stories about the Mary D. family say. They arrived in, you know, at that, in that year.
Okay.
So, but, you know.
And that still happens to this day. There's a core group, and you know, throughout the years, a couple will leave and a couple will come. And but there's, you always, like you say, there's the core group that start to finish.
That's exactly what happened.
Soup to nuts.
That's soup to nuts.
Yeah.
So anyway, a couple other things I wanted to say about, you know, Gertrude Ball was really special to me, and I like to think it that she was special to all of the kids, all of the children. She referred to them as her children in her class. And I would think that others have taken the same things away from her tutelage as I did. But she was special, and she introduced children to the world beyond our homes as well as beyond our shores. And one of the ways she did that was through music, I think, is my opinion. And getting back to the – so she would open – we had morning exercises in her class every day, and she would – start those morning exercises by singing a little ditty that goes like this. I'll recite it, not sing it.
Okay.
So she would say, the ditty goes like this. Good morning, dear children. Good morning to all. The clock strikes the hour and we come at its call. And she would be singing that. And then we would all rise as she's singing that and stand next to our desks. And immediately upon her finishing the ditty, then she'd lead us in the Lord's Prayer.
Oh, boy.
And then we'd continue on to the 23rd Psalm. So, you know, as that also went out at some point, probably before Gertrude stopped teaching. But it's something that I'll take to my grave because it was special.
Yeah.
And it reflected the times in so many respects. And
what did all the Muslim and Jewish kids do while you guys were doing?
Well, you know,
we didn't have
it. Oh, sorry. Right.
Interesting. You should ask that question, because I'll segue to say that Gertrude was a Catholic. The Donnelly family were the only Catholic kids in the school at that point, or attending Catholic, practicing Catholics. And so I'm a Baptist. I was raised a Baptist. I'll always be a Baptist. I married a Catholic woman, and
snuck that one in there.
There goes the neighborhood.
Best thing that happened to my life was marrying her. And one of the things I've learned from her Catholicism is that there are two Catholic priests that have stood out in my lifetime as people who made a difference in hers and our marriage, in her and in our marriage. And that was the priest that she, at the church she attended in Sharon, Mass, when we lived there for 10 years, and Father Kehoe on Block Island. Not that others aren't worthy, but those two are worthy of mention.
Many people have mentioned Father Kehoe, I feel like.
Father Kehoe was very special to me as well.
Right.
He was a very, I don't even have words to really describe it. He wasn't a strict man, but he had expectations of you. So you could really literally go with him with anything. And I felt that his ultimate goal was the care of the person, not whether you broke a little rule or something
right.
like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And
he
was just, it didn't matter. It was almost like the difference between the dad who wants to slap you and the dad who just says, it's okay, come here, and he gives you a hug, even though you did something you shouldn't have done. And I kind of feel that that's how he was. And I mean, I know that that's the whole premise. You can go confessional, but it wasn't like that. I don't know how to explain it. He truly, you know, he's the reason that I actually went to church at 8 a.m. with Gertie. Because of him. You know what I mean? Like, it was actually a joy to go and hear him speak and talk to him before and after. So he married us.
Oh, we did.
Yeah, and he wore I forget the name of it, what the priests will wear. It's like the thing that they drape over around their neck and down, flows down. And he wore the one my grandmother made for him.
Nice.
Or gave him. Either gave him or made him. I can't remember, which I don't want to boast on either one of those. But yeah, he was a good one. I'm glad you mentioned him.
So, interestingly enough, Tony Pappas married Peggy and I.
Oh, there you go. Yep, so you swayed to the Baptist side on the wedding.
Well, you know, it was, where were we living at the time? She was living, I was living in Stoughton, Massachusetts, and she was living in Randolph, Massachusetts. And it was, we were going to be married on Block Island, and Tony was my choice, and she was happy with Tony as her choice.
Well, thank you, listeners, and that concludes part one of our interview with David Lewis. Please join us next week for part two. What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with